Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of March. We are going to speak this hour with Elizabeth Wheel, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. And I'm sure those of you who read the Times on Sunday found yourself reading the article. It was a cover story for the magazine on March 10 that looked at teaching boys and girls separately. She talks about new single-sex public schools and classrooms opening at an accelerating pace. In the fall of 2002, there were only about a dozen public schools in this country that had any kind of single-sex educational options. This past fall, the number was 360. A disproportionate number of schools are in the South, she writes, where attitudes toward gender roles tend to be more conservative or serve disadvantaged students. And many more of these schools are in the pipeline for next year. We'll look at those who favor segregating the sexes, and we'll look at what research there is on all of this, which may be slimmer than you think. And Elizabeth is our guest this hour. We're going to have a lot of phone calls, and of course I'd be particularly interested in hearing from parents or teachers, if you are not teaching right now, school administrators who are in these kinds of settings, and I know there are some of them in the Milwaukee area, or some of you who have strong thoughts one way or the other about whether or not this is a good idea. Elizabeth, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting how really a couple people, several books, have really fueled this whole movement, right? These very, and we've interviewed some of these guys, Michael Gurian particularly, who really fueled the movement that the brains are different in girls and boys, and basically because of that, separate them and they do much better.
Right. You know, those books have gotten a lot of traction in the past few years, and I think they really speak to parents' concerns.
Yes, and parents' concerns, what, that their boys are not performing very well? Or
yeah, there's been a lot of attention in the media and from all over the place that boys are now the ones who are in a crisis. In the mid and late 90s, there was a lot of attention paid to the fact that girls were in crisis,
right,
particularly middle school girls, and that a girl would get into middle school and her self-esteem would plummet, and she'd lose interest in math and science, and that had its own set of problems. And more recently, people have been talking about a boy crisis, that boys aren't performing as well as girls in school. And writers like Michael Gurian are addressing the concerns of parents of boys, primarily, who feel concerned about how their boys are performing or how their boys might perform later.
Right. It is, and you write this, that separating boys and girls in school has long been a staple of private and parochial education. Why is that? Do we know? It's just a given that it would be that way in parochial
schools.
That's
really interesting. I didn't look into the research of that, and so I can give you my two cents, not based on
yeah,
much.
Yeah, that's all right.
But, you know, socially, There is a strong desire, I think, particularly once the kids are not in elementary school, to split up boys and girls so they're not distracted by each other. And, you know, concerns about sexuality come up in high school and in middle school. And so there has been, I think, a desire on that part for parents to sort of allay those concerns. And then, you know, traditionally there have been a lot of elite institutions that have been very successful, that were single sex, and some of them still are. You know, there's still a lot of very highly regarded private schools, particularly in urban areas, that are just boys or just girls.
Right.
And of course, until I think it was mostly the late 60s and early 70s, you know, Harvard was all male and Yale was all male, and these places that were sort of the height of education were single sex.
Right. I was amazed. You start the article with this interesting story of the school in Foley, Alabama, where they go so far as to have temperatures different in girls' classrooms when you compare them to boys' classrooms. I've never heard of such a thing.
Right. Well, Leonard Sachs, who I write a bit about, who in some ways is like Michael Gurian, and he writes pretty popular books that sort of take brain research and sort of package it in a way that's easier for a non-scientist to digest. And so he, some of these things are in his lectures and not in his books, but sort of culled the scientific research and found ways in which boys and girls have different needs and different brains and different ways of hearing and different ways of seeing. And he sort of distilled these down to things that a school or a classroom could do. And one of the things that he suggests is that girls need their classrooms to be warmer. A girl wants to be in a classroom that's about 75 degrees, I believe. I'd have to look back at my notes. And that boys like their classrooms cooler, I believe, 69 degrees. And he has suggestions that the walls of the boys' classrooms be blue and the walls of the girls' classrooms be yellow. And I should say right now that I take some issue with some of these points. Mm-hmm. But Zach does, he does a lot of teacher trainings and school trainings, and he does make these suggestions.
75, you think you'd fall asleep, wouldn't you?
I think I would.
I think I would, too. That's a little bit too warm. The other thing that's interesting is how parents and administrators, and you write about people, principals who are high on these ideas, and they get parents together and administrators together and have them read a book by Gurian or give them some information, and everybody's gung-ho. They take to this immediately.
Right. I'm not sure everybody's gung-ho, but I do feel that particularly in a struggling school district, or like the school district in Foley, Alabama, the principal was really concerned about how her minority boys were performing, and she wanted to do something that might help raise the achievement of her minority boys. And she had read one of Michael Gurian's books called Boys and Girls Learn Differently, mm-hmm. and it had really spoken to her, and then she read a magazine article Sachs wrote, and she decided, you know what, let's give this a try. Let's see if we separate our boys and girls, if our achievement will increase. And I think in a lot, she's not in an urban school district, but I think a similar thing happens in a lot of urban school districts where teachers and administrators and parents are incredibly frustrated by their performance, and they want to try something to improve it.
Right.
And they often have really limited funds, and separating boys and girls is something you can do without a huge influx of money.
So do you think that that the people who are advocating this, Gurian and Sachs and others, can be validly criticized for cherry-picking their views, or are they really – is this very exhaustive research that shows that brains are very different, that emotions are very different, that how fast they learn and when you should go to school is different, that there's all a lot of empirical research there?
Well, there are a lot of different issues at play. I feel it is completely fair to criticize their use of science. And here's a sort of, simple way to try to understand what's happening. There's a lot of brain research going on right now. There are a lot of brain scans, and, there have been a lot of popular books, too, addressing, how male and female brains are different. So there is good basic research that will show that how a girl's brain develops is different from how a boy's brain develops. Mm-hmm. What does not exist is good research linking that to education. So you can say, okay, a girl's brain develops differently than a boy's brain, but to then make the leap to say you should put them in different classrooms, to me is a step too far. And there are also concerns that I have and others in the scientific and education communities that Sachs and Gurian too uses data in misleading ways. And so perhaps there will be a very small difference in how boys and girls hear, and a difference that is negligible in a classroom setting. But Sachs will then take that very small difference and the fact that it exists and blow it up and use it to say, well, you can't possibly have, or it's not good to have boys and girls in the same room, because when a teacher is speaking at a level that is audible and comfortable for the boys, the girls will perceive her as screaming.
Mm-hmm. What about these statistics, though, that are quite serious, that boys are getting suspended at much greater rates? They make up 2/3 of special education students. They're 1.5 times more likely to be held back a grade and 2.5 times more likely to be given an ADHD diagnosis.
Well, there are definitely real concerns with how boys are performing in school. From my understanding of the research, and I didn't have, a year to exhaustively look into this, there's a very, the numbers that minority boys are really underperforming are real and very concerning.
Yes.
The issue of whether middle-class boys and non-minority boys are in an education crisis is more debatable.
Mm-hmm. Go to this school, which you say is widely considered the birthplace of the current single-sex public school movement, the Young Women's Leadership School in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be an exceptional school.
It's a remarkable school. I visited some really amazing schools while researching this story. So this is a school that's in East Harlem, and all the students come from the community, and they are not, only the best and the brightest coming out of elementary school. It's a middle school and a high school. And the kids just blossom there. 100% of the seniors graduate and are accepted to four-year colleges. The opportunities that school gives these girls are really, really remarkable.
Yeah, that's quite a statistic that they're going on to college in those kinds of numbers.
And they get a lot of love, and they have the school gets some supplemental funding from a woman named Ann Tisch at a foundation she runs called the Young Women's Leadership Foundation. So through that foundation, the school is funded for a health and wellness program, which the city of New York can't fund for them, and also a college counseling program, which is really remarkable. The kids start being taken to visit Columbia and other colleges in New York in the seventh grade, and they are sort of told you will go to college from day one in that school. And I think those kinds of messages make a huge difference.
Right. So what may be most important here is the character piece, as you write about, giving children a positive sense of themselves as students. It's a hard thing to do, but it's crucial.
It's crucial, yeah. So a big part of what's going on at that school is the message all those girls are getting, that they're smart, that they're capable, that they're going somewhere, that there are opportunities for them in the world. The school does a very good job of setting the kids up with summer programs and after-school programs and just sort of showing them, like, yes, you might not have thought before you walked in the door here that there were tons of opportunities available for you. You know, as a girl growing up in Harlem, that might not have seemed to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
But we can show you differently. And the kids do incredible science projects. They have really engaged teachers. So a lot of things are going on in that school in addition to it just being an all-girls school.
So maybe they can provide part of the answer. We just had, as I'm sure you're aware, a study of the CHOICE program in Milwaukee, which was the pioneer, and it's been around since 1990 here, kind of mixed results as to whether or not it's helping to improve scores of minority students. But we face a crisis in this country in terms of what's happening with our minority students, what's happening with our poor students, that we don't have an answer. And it seems as though part of single sex is, well, let's try single sex. Well, let's try choice schools. Well, let's try, what are we going to do to improve the performance of those students?
Right. Well, single sex schools definitely sort of fall under the choice umbrella of saying to parents, let us give you more options. Let us, have more things available. If you think your kid will perform better in this type of school, let's give it a try. And one piece that I found very interesting was often and I haven't seen the report you referenced, so I'm not sure if this was a finding there, but one thing people talk about with single-sex education is that in public schools, that an important step is that a parent buys into the idea and therefore might be more engaged with their child's schooling, and that itself can make a tremendous difference.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Elizabeth Wheel is our guest, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, wrote the cover story for the magazine on March 2nd, which looks at teaching boys and girls separately. It's a very thorough article. It looks at, she's talked with the people who have advocated these schools. It looks at why it is they're growing in number, although there are also are a number of schools that have closed that just haven't worked. And I guess one of the basic questions that we keep asking is, what is it that we can do to really make sure that our poor students in this country, be they in Wisconsin or New York or Alabama, are given a positive sense of themselves as students who can exceed? Is that easier to achieve if you have single-sex classrooms or not? And is there a lot of study that shows that students perform much better in single-sex classrooms? What do you think? Oh, our phone lines are jammed, so we'll take your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, as many of you know and have referenced in your calls, I've experienced some significant health issues, heart issues in the last month and a half. And so many of you have written to me or called, and thank you. You You've been terrific. You made me feel good. Saying, why don't you do a program on heart health and what it is we can do to keep our hearts healthy, or if you've had coronary disease, how it can be treated. So I have persuaded my cardiologist to do a show tomorrow. He's a wonderful man, Dr. Lee Biblow, who's at Frederick here in Milwaukee. So he will be with us tomorrow to talk about our hearts and how to make them healthy, how to make sure they are healthy, and how to deal with heart disease. So that's coming up tomorrow during this time period. Elizabeth Wheel is here now. We're talking about whether or not we should teach boys and girls separately. What do you think? 800-486-8655 is the number, and Dan from White Lake is our first caller. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Hi.
All of this is anecdotal evidence, but I had the good fortune of going to a Jesuit school in Detroit, starting in high school and all the way through college and law school, and to a master's degree in biology. My sister went to an all-girls school run by Dominican nuns in Detroit for high school, and then went to co-ed university and ended up with a master's degree in biology. But my kid brother never went to a gender-separated school in his life and ended up with a Ph.D. in physics from MIT in Boston. And
So you all did just fine.
We did fine.
Yeah.
Your mother must be proud.
Yeah.
Words of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar,
right,
who went to an all-boys Jesuit-run high school in Manhattan and said, here we are in high school with hormones running through our bodies like juju bees, and the priests are saying, take cold showers. If you can't understand, I don't think it makes any difference whatsoever in grade school, but if you can't understand why educating children separately in high school, I don't think it makes any difference in grade school, but in high school, that's a time when I think that whatever's going on between the sexes at least ought to be kept out of the classroom, simply to make people pay more attention to what they're supposed to be doing, which is learning.
Yeah, Dan, I think you make an excellent point. Elizabeth, what do you think?
Well, I think a lot of people agree with you. I have a few thoughts on it. It's interesting. A lot of people feel that the most important time for boys to be in gender-separated classroom is actually in elementary school. So this comes out of people who are focusing on sort of brain research and developmental studies. And so they will say it's important to separate boys and girls in elementary school because at the young ages, the boys are behind the girls. Boys tend to develop more slowly than girls. And at kindergarten age, at 5 or 6, the boys are often substantially behind. And some suggest that this sort of gets boys off to a bad start, that they start feeling that they're not very capable students, and then they start not liking school, and that has a whole spiral. But, of course, many, many, many people agree with what you just said, including an incredible English teacher I saw at the Young Women's Leadership School in New York who was teaching literature. She was teaching a class on Pride and Prejudice, and sort of the girls were talking about the sex and the sexuality in that book in a really open way and in a way that really related to their lives. It's really what you hope for when you think about a room full of high school seniors discussing literature. Mm-hmm. And that conversation would have never happened in a co-ed classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Dan, very much for your call. We go to Steve from Rice Lake. Hi, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
It might be a subject for an entirely different show, but in the photos accompanying that essay, all the children are in classroom uniforms. And I'm wondering if that was true throughout the separated sex classrooms, that she found that the children were also in uniforms. And I'm wondering why that's not a policy that's advocated much more, except for the influence of the clothing industry.
You know, a lot of the single-sex classrooms I saw, the kids were in uniforms. Not all. And I think there are ways in which, the choice to have a public school be in uniforms and the choice to be single-sex, they can sort of all be part of a program of wanting to get kids focused on school, less focused on, the outside forces of youth culture, which many kids and parents and teachers, everybody all finds distracting. So while they don't have to go hand in hand, I think they often do.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned one school, I think, and I can't remember where it was now, Elizabeth, where there are uniforms and there's a lot of discipline. It's the boys' school.
Yes, the Excellence Charter School in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Right.
Yes, those boys, they're incredibly cute. I have to say that's not very professional of me, but these little boys are there with their ties.
Oh.
And their sweaters and their white shirts and their black sneakers. And the school makes a point of referring to their students as professional scholars. Part of the message they want to give their kids is that that's good to take themselves seriously as students. Hmm. And that and part of that comes through the uniform of saying we want you to dress like a professional. We want you to behave like a professional.
Hmm.
And there is a lot of discipline at that school, but it feels all very focused on this message of you are a scholar, you are going somewhere, we want you to achieve.
Hmm.
And partly also saying, you know, whatever those influences are going on outside of the school building, which in many of those families are pretty chaotic, to be saying, this is a different place. You dress differently here, you behave differently here.
Interesting. Do you get dressed up to go to work?
Do I?
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I am sitting in my home office in my basement in jeans and a sweatshirt.
Yeah, and I have to go to rehab today, so I've got sort of a running outfit on.
I wish it's glory of radio.
And
sometimes I have to say, you know, I believe that, you know, while clothes aren't the most important thing in the world, you can sort of be sending a message to yourself also by how you dress. So
right.
Some days I put it together a little bit more.
Thanks very much for the call, Steve. Let's go next to Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I come from a background about 45 years in education, going back about that time. And I think that mixing up the classroom with boys and girls, and I'm speaking for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, I think it's much better. But I may be a little bit prejudiced on that because I never taught in single classrooms where you had just boys or girls. And I also think, too, about 75% of it comes from what the teacher expects out of students in the classroom. I think that's basically what it boils down to. And if you're fair with the kids, you can do a good job, either with girls and boys together, and get about as much out about either one. But you've got to be able to work at it, and you've also got to be very careful at it, particularly when situations will come up. So,
Elizabeth.
Well, I think that's a very good point, that I felt like a lot of what I was seeing in good single-gendered schools was good teaching, and good teaching that could have been, in some cases, in a co-ed classroom, too. It seems that also for some of the teachers I spoke with who had sort of recently switched from co-ed to single-gender, it was a really interesting new challenge. It was really motivating for them to sort of think in a new way and in a focused way about how can I best reach my students, how can I best be. I spoke with a fourth grade all-girls teacher who had put a lot of energy in the past few years into figuring out how to teach her girls math and science, and she was doing a phenomenal job. You know, she had the kids for math. They had a store, and they were doing all kinds of stuff with that, and they were doing really interesting science experiments, and the girls were reacting really well. And she did also acknowledge to me that if she thought she went back to co-ed, she would use those same techniques, and her boys would also respond really well.
Hmm.
So I think it can go both ways. I mean, I also think there are some risks of single gender education and sort of what message are you giving students? Because no matter what you're saying overtly, the fact of putting the boys in one room and the girls in another room gives them a very clear message that boys and girls are really different.
Mm-hmm. The only time we did that was when we were learning the facts of life. Remember those classes?
Yes.
Yeah. One day, I think it was one day when I was growing up. Wait, what about the, you talk about the ACLU opposing all single-sex public education. What kind of message does it give, they say, when you tell a group of kids that boys and girls need to be separated because they don't even see or hear alike?
Right. And sort of what I was talking about earlier, you know, there was a lot of energy in the late 60s and early 70s to make sure that the best schools in this country, particularly at the university level, were co-ed, that was a very important part of the women's movement,
mm-hmm.
that we didn't want to be separating you know, males and females in education because we wanted everybody to have the same opportunities. And, you know, of course, that was a very important lesson with race, you know, in Brown versus Board of Education. Separate is not equal. And so the ACLU, among others, just has very big concerns about segregating classrooms and feels that we have a very bad history with this and that it's not appropriate. That if you want to go to an after-school club that's all girls, or you want to go to, you know, a church where, in Sunday school the kids are separated by boys and girls, fine, but that's not appropriate for public school. And of course, there's Title IX, which is a regulation saying that any school that accepts public funding cannot segregate on the basis of sex.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, very much for your call. Let's go to Diane from Milwaukee. Hello.
Thank you. There was an old study in England about giving children vitamin tablets or a vitamin-enriched snack in the morning, and that raised their IQ level 4 to 5 points. I think maybe some of our minority parents have jobs that start earlier than the kids go to school, so they miss out on breakfast, or perhaps are too poor to really afford the most nutritious food. I think that's a big part of learning.
Elizabeth.
Clearly, this boy school we were talking about a minute ago, the Excellence Charter School, you know, they start really early. They start at, I think the boys come at 7:30, and they make sure their kids are fed. I don't want to speak too much. This is out of memory, not out of my notes. But there is a lot. That very issue is a really important one, and one that I think school districts more and more are paying attention to be saying we need to meet our kids' needs. And if our kids are going to learn to read and they're going to learn math, you know, they need to be fed. They need to sleep. If they have really serious issues going on at home, they need someone to talk to about that stuff.
Sure. Yeah, they sure do. Schools have to do so much, don't they, Elizabeth? Whew.
They really do, and it seems like schools that are really achieving in urban public schools are doing so much for their students.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to see the whole picture, I think, not just what goes on inside a math class or an English class.
Thanks, Diane, for your call. We go to John from Algoma. Hi, John.
Hi. Wonderful show this morning. I've had the privilege of working overseas in education programs a fair amount, and I'm surprised, I guess, that you know, you aren't talking about research that relates privilege, particularly male privilege, and class, which impacts on whether people go to gender-separate educational programs overseas. Because of resource limitations, at least in part, and because of gender privilege, you see sexually segregated schools. Those oftentimes are amplified by social norms which require separation of the sexes far more rigidly than in our own country. And I would be, and you mentioned the ACLU, I would be most concerned that the consequence of separation would be a reduction in resources available to the female students, because it is ultimately about resources and privilege. I think if you look historically, you would see the same in terms of education in the United States, where education, the best quote-unquote education, was available to males, and public education was both genders. And it's really about resources and privilege.
Elizabeth.
Well, I think you make a very good point. I think the law as it now exists, the regulations changed in 2006. In 2006, as part of No Child Left Behind, the federal government made it easier for school districts to experiment with separating boys and girls, and it was part of a whole suite of regulations that made school choice easier. And so there is, in that, by law, the resources do need to be the same. And my suspicion is that school districts are doing a pretty good job of that. But I share your feeling that it's a really major concern, and that sort of, and if you look at our history and history in other countries, there's not a very good track record. So I think it is really important to proceed with caution and to make sure that, that resources are being given out fairly.
We have an email from Travis who says, I would hate this personally. What happens to tomboys? What happens to gays and lesbians? Both statistically would thoroughly not enjoy being separated into these gender-specific groups, and they make up 10% of our population. This does not prepare our youth for the future setting as our workplaces are not split up by genders.
Those are really real concerns. One other thing that's important to know, at least in public single-sex schools, is that nobody can be assigned to them. They are voluntary programs, and so a parent would have to decide, I want this for my child. And so one hopes that a parent would be tuned in enough to their own children to sort of be making those judgments of, is this program something that my child would enjoy? Is it a place where my child would thrive? So on sort of the personal level, the fear of a child being assigned to one of these classrooms and hating it, of course it's a real concern, but one that you could hope could be dealt with within families. The other concern of, does this prepare children, you know, to go out and be part of a co-ed workforce? I mean, that's a concern I have heard a lot, and I do think it's a real one.
Mm-hmm.
That said, a teacher said something really interesting to me about this. She said she thinks of school as practice, that school is not the real world. School is a practice environment. It's a safe place to practice both your intellectual skills and your social skills.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's her feeling, she teaches all girls, that her girls get to practice being outspoken. They get to practice, you know, collecting their ideas and voicing them strongly. And she feels that's easier for them to do in an all-girls setting. And then when they do go out into a co-ed workforce, they'll be in a better position to do that because they really got to practice in a safe environment.
Hmm. Thank you, John, so much for your call. We go to Barbara from De Pere next. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Fine, thank
Good.
You. I have two quick questions and a comment. You just addressed the competition. I'm wondering how girls will go out, and boys that are separated in school, will go out into the business world and feel like they can compete with the opposite sex. Also, another question I have is, at the segregated gender schools, do male teachers teach in the female schools and females in the male, or is it totally female with female? Also, my last comment is, I'm thinking that this doesn't all have to take place just in schools. I think a lot of it there may have to be some parent education. I'm thinking children need expectations from their parents as well as themselves and their teachers. And you're talking about a lot of low income, and I'm wondering if those are not a lot of one-parent schools, households.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if they then go and teach parents more parenting skills and educational skills. So I'll take your answer offline. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
All right. Well, the point about going out into the workforce, I'm not sure I have too much more to say on that, so I'll mm-hmm. jump to your next question about, are the teachers the same sex as the students? And I feel I should say now, I didn't go to every school, like, so I can't speak for everywhere. I saw more classrooms with same-sex teachers than opposite-sex teachers, but I really did see classrooms with opposite-sex teachers. And I think there's something to be said for that, too. And I saw it both ways. I saw female teachers teaching classrooms of boys and male teachers teaching classrooms of girls. And that in some way seems very important and can help lay some of the other fears. One male teacher at a girls' high school was saying to me at the school in Harlem, you know, that for some of his students, for some of the girls, he was one of the first men that they'd had a really consistent trusting relationship within life, that they didn't have a father figure, and so here he was, and he was like a man for them to start modeling a relationship on, of, you know, how do you form trust, and he felt, and I agreed with him, that that was an incredibly important lesson that they were learning in school in addition to everything else. And then as to the parent education, I feel like that's a little outside my realm of expertise, although I agree with you 100%, and I know of some really interesting programs that are trying to do that, you know, starting with parents of babies. to say, if we really want to educate our kids and we really want to sort of reach children when they're young enough that it can make a big difference in their lives before they get off to a bad start, we really need to be getting to the parents. And I couldn't agree with that more.
But you do write about the phenomenally short number of hours that teachers are trained in single-sex education. It's very short, isn't it?
You know, not always, but some schools are not spending very long training their teachers on this. And I feel like almost everything in life, you probably get out what you put in. And so if a district's not spending a very long time training their teachers, my guess is that they're making less of an impact.
Right.
And, you know, some of these other schools that I mentioned on the show spend a very long time before opening their doors, you know, years.
Hmm.
And that, too, probably comes down to resources, you know, that you have a beleaguered public school without a lot of funds. And
right.
They probably just can't do it.
Right. We go to Tina from Madison next. Hi, Tina.
Hi. For me, the whole issue of girls and kind of single-sex or same-sex education always has made a lot of sense to me because I think it's good for girls to have that opportunity, as you've mentioned, to sort of learn how to argue and to deal with the real world. And I think that they do just fine. Having known colleagues and friends who went to all-girls schools, it seems to me they do really, really well. But I've become more and more convinced that for boys, they really could use this kind of thing in the early grades and being in and out of schools, observing in the last couple of years. I've noticed that especially boys of color get very quickly categorized as troublemakers, or they do have a they often have different learning styles. They're more apt to do things that sometimes the white female teachers just don't agree with. And so I feel like a lot of those boys get turned off education so early. So I think it would be great to see how this would work, and I would be for public schools trying it. If it works, maybe we should go with it.
Well, just that group of boys I serve as at the center of a lot of the debate about single-sex public education, and a feeling that, like, we are really failing those boys that you mentioned, the boys who get pegged as troublemakers really early on, and that we need to try something else. We need to do something for them. And at least at this boys' school in Bed-Stuy that I've talked about, the excellent school, you know, they feel like a very big part of the message is telling those kids, you can do this, you know, that this is important. When I was visiting the school, one of the administrators was saying to me, you know, that in white upper-middle-class families, you know, that kid in the labor and delivery room gets put in, you know, some college onesie, like, you know, some University of Wisconsin in Madison or whatever it is, you know, some message to that kid that you are going to college. And for a lot of poor and minority kids, that's not a message they're getting. And it's an important message to give them, perhaps even before they know what they're talking about, what you're talking about as a parent, but to be saying, you know, you're going somewhere, you're going to college, can be a really important part of the lesson.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Tina? Tina's gone. Thanks for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our guest this hour is Elizabeth Wheel. Elizabeth wrote the cover story for the New York Times Magazine on March 2nd that's on teaching boys and girls separately. She's a contributing writer for the Times. This is a growing trend in this country, although there are some schools that have gone this way and they've said it's not working, and so they're not doing that anymore. But as she cites, this past fall, the number of schools were 360, disproportionately in the South, and there will be many more for the next school year. Is it working? Based on what's the research here? 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now for Elizabeth, and we go to Spencer from Milwaukee. Hi, Spencer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been only listening off and on, so I don't know if you've addressed this, but I think that a conversation we need to have is I don't think it's fair to say that we need to prepare every student for college, and that sort of that's the only valued track, that you know, succeeding means going to college, not only because I just don't think that everyone is really equipped for sort of that much education and that much dedication and all that takes to really succeed at college and not just sort of float through. But there are also lots of professions that are completely worthwhile and our society needs that are really being underserved by our education system because, you know, plumbers are not really valued. And I think a part of this is that there really is, at least when I was in public school, there wasn't much career education, career placement to what's really out there and what are the options to be preparing for. It was just sort of either you go to college or, well, we don't really mention anything else. And I think that's a big lacking in our education system.
Well, you know, this is a little outside my field of this article, though it's very interesting to me because I've just started looking into the possibility of writing a little bit about high school. And the points you make are a really big part of the debate among education thinkers and scholars right now. And there's a feeling among some people, at least, that the way we've conceived high school is failing a lot of kids for just the reasons you mentioned, that on both sides, that kids aren't being well prepared for jobs that don't require an advanced degree, that there's not good vocational training. And at the same time, a lot of people are feeling that kids aren't being very well prepared for college either. I think it was Bill Gates who said a few years ago they felt that high school was obsolete. It wasn't really serving anybody. So I think your points are very well taken.
Thanks so much for your call, Spencer. We go to Green Bay next. Is it Edie or Eddie?
It's Eddie.
Eddie. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. I apologize if I missed it, but since I've been listening to this program, I haven't heard anybody that was actually a product of a single-sex school, and
right.
I was.
Oh, yeah, we did. We heard from one gentleman, but you were. High school or all the way through or what?
Grammar school was co-ed. High school was single-sex. And my first semester of college was single-sex before I switched to a larger university.
Mm-hmm.
But I really think that it was key to my success later on in life. Hmm. It was a real opportunity for girls not only to be on the student council, but to be the president of the student council, to be editors of the yearbook, to take charge in all of the extracurricular activities, and to be able to voice their opinions, as your guest has said, without being criticized or feeling, you know, are the boys going to think I'm too smart and I'm not going to be popular? I also had a lot of friends who were boys who went to single-sex schools, and, you know, they succeeded when they got into college. They were focused in high school and not distracted by the girls in their classroom. And I think most of us felt that it was an incredibly beneficial experience.
Elizabeth.
Well, you know, I heard the same thing. I personally went to co-ed public school, so I can't speak from my own experience. But particularly in this one girls' high school I spent some time in New York, you know, that the girls were saying the same thing, or teachers were telling me about alumni who had come back from moving from an all-girls high school to a co-ed college, and they would, you know, report that they were so confident in talking in class, and they didn't understand what the big deal was, that the boys didn't have anything interesting to say. You know, sort of in a funny way, that they felt great about how well prepared they were, mm-hmm. and how confident they had become.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would recommend it to any school district that was having problems. I think it was the greatest thing that my parents could have done was sending me to a single-sex school.
Hmm. Thanks, Eddie.
I mean, I feel like one point that for me in writing this became very important is that it's such a contentious issue for political reasons that I feel like it's easy to lose the fact that we're talking about individual kids, and that for some individual kids this is probably a great idea. And as another caller raised, you know, his concerns about, you know, tomboys and you know, kids who aren't sort of gender stereotypical, that it's probably not such a great idea. You know, I'm the mother of two girls. They are so different from one another. And I think one would love being in a single-gender school and one would hate it.
Hmm. We go to Jim next from Wausau. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon or this morning?
Okay, how are you?
I'm getting confused with the time changes now.
Yeah.
I was raised in Chicago. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school. And I think, I don't know if anyone's brought up during the past hour, like, you know, the effect of hormones, especially on a young boy, during those times can be very distracting with teenage girls in the room with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in my case, I really benefited. I got good grades. I did a lot better when I finished high school. And a lot of my friends who went to public school, especially in the Chicago school district, it's I know it cost my parents a great deal of sacrifice to send me there. But in the end, I think the fact that I was in an all boys school helped benefit me down the road. Just keeping the distractions of girls out of my head during the time that I was there. You know, trying to focus on German and math and art and history and all the good things that I was able to pick up on over the years.
Elizabeth.
You know, that's a really valid, really common concern, you know, among parents. You know, will my kid be really distracted? And that sort of gets lumped into sort of what people call sort of the social piece or the character piece. And a lot of education scholars agree with you that a single-sex school can really sort of shape a more what the people often call pro-academic culture, where kids, just as you were saying with your own experience, you know, are more focused on, you know, the scholarship at hand and less focused on the social concerns of, you know, figuring out what it's, you know, like to grow up and become a sexual being.
Yeah.
It can be very distracting.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for the call. On email, is there any research on the amount of bullying that happens in single-sex classrooms, girls excluding other girls because of cattiness or boys physically intimidating other boys?
You know, I don't know. I didn't see that research. If it exists, it may well exist, but I didn't see that.
Joe is next from Richland Center. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
My question is, I attended public school, and there were classrooms where it was guys only and classrooms where it was girls only. But it seemed like no matter what class we were in, it wasn't so much the difference between girls and boys that made learning difficult. It was the jocks in the room that always had the comment that disrupted everything. My question is that do these private schools, segregated schools, have sports like football, basketball, so forth, or are sports just not involved? And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
My understanding is that the sporting programs are the same as they would have been anyway. I'm not aware of any difference, you know, being linked between single-gender education and athletic programs.
Mm-hmm. You talk a little bit in the articles about districts that have started single-gender schools only to shut them down. Have there been a lot of such schools, Elizabeth?
You know, on that, too, I feel a little badly about it. The research that exists on this topic is not very thorough. So I can sort of only speak anecdotally. Yes, some schools that have gone down this road have decided not to anymore. And I think particularly once you're out of elementary school and kids are going to different classrooms for different math classes, for different English classes, for different science classes, that scheduling becomes a very big concern. So one principal that I had spoken with that was the first public middle school in the country to go to single-gender classrooms was now in the process of reverting back to co-ed, largely because she felt that the complexities of her master schedule were so enormous and they were not offset by the academic gain she was seeing. So, you know, she not only needed to figure out, well, you know, student A needs to go from this math class to that kind of science class to that kind of math class, but also now make sure, well, student A is a boy, so all those need to be boys' classrooms, and student B is a girl, and it just became overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about research here? Would you believe, then, that there needs to be a whole lot more research done in all areas here about boys and girls learning differently and brain differences and whether or not schools should go this route? Is the research really lacking?
I really do believe that we need more research, particularly on sort of linking basic research about how boys and girls develop and how their brains develop to education. There is currently not a link between those two. And so there's a lot of playing fast and loose with the science to say, well, you know, a girl's brain looks different from a boy's brain, so we need to put the girl in a different classroom. And to my mind, it is way premature to be saying that right now.
A little, about a minute left. Bill from Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Wonderful show. I mentioned this before on the show months ago that there, at Teachers College in the mid-80s, the president gave an address and said, we really do know what makes successful schools. And all the things you've raised are also critical. But the basic ones are decent teachers, not superb teachers, good decent, healthy facilities. They're not falling on kids' heads. Nutrition and feeding and health. That'd be the third. Parent involvement. And there's a fifth, but I'm too old and I forgot it. But the point is, all these things really interlap or interact. It's hard to have parent involvement if the neighborhood's poor or they have strange working hours or don't work or aren't capable of dealing with the school bureaucracy. There are a whole bunch of issues there. And we tend to look at these as one-off issues, you know, boys versus girls, and or, you know, public versus private. I went to a private boarding school that had all these things. It was supposed to be wonderful, but they did not do something your speaker has mentioned, your guest has mentioned. They did not really make all kids really feel that they were important and valuable. Mm. In fact, the faculty was involved in hazing and
baiting. On that note, we have to just ponder that because we're out of time. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the article.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Wheel, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and the cover story was March 2nd on teaching boys and girls separately. You can go online and read it if you would like. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thank you for calling and listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.